Nothing hindered their movement until they reached the access area for the Special Materials Fabrication Unit. The shift supervisor for the Special Materials Fabrication Facility was a solid, graying petty chief who was not intimidated by a mere four officers.
App can't do that. It's in use. There's 90 meters of whisker in the drum now. You'll have to have permission from Commander Dorse, and he wouldn't—
Stand aside, or there'll be 90 meters of whisker where the stars don't shine.
Admiral Dawson will kill me if you get in there and destroy an entire batch.
No, the Blood Horde will kill you. The Admiral will only break you to pivot and then give you 20 years hard time if you don't get out of the way!
Blood Horde? What does the Blood Horde have to do with it?
Esme stepped forward, trying to project harmlessness and a pure heart.
Haven't you heard anything?
No, I haven't. I've been monitoring a startup whisker for the past 5 hours, and my relief hasn't shown up.
Bloodhorde commandos are loose on the ship, and your relief is probably dead. The only way we can fight them is to get out of T1, and the only way out of T1 is through here. I suggest you let us pass, and when we're safely out, let the Bloodhorde in if they show up. Then do a break off early.
But that'd be 90 meters wasted!
Freeze had moved to the other side of the chief from Esme.
Excuse me.
What?
Esme hoped she hadn't hit him too hard. She'd find time to feel bad about it later. They barricaded the hatch to the passage as well as they could and climbed quickly into the EVA suits in the nearby locker. They checked each other's suits before opening the first of the lockout hatches that isolated the Special Materials Fabrication Unit from the ship's artificial gravity. Inside was a metal grid walkway 10 meters long, ending in another lockout hatch. Rails ran along either bulkhead, with rings set every half meter. They went in, closed the hatch behind them, and punched for airless entry. The light ahead of them turned green, and they started down the walkway. Esme felt herself lifting with each step, as if she were walking in deepening water. In the last meter, her steps pushed her off the walkway completely, and her feet trailed back, lured by the weak attraction of Kosciusko's real mass.
I hate frickin' Zero-G.
I hate the Blood Horde. Zero-G is just a nuisance.
They cycled through the second lockout hatch into a long, dark tube lit by the eerie purple and green glow of the growth tank. It seemed to go on and on, narrowing to a dark point far away. Here, Esme couldn't feel the slightest hint of attraction to any mass. Her stomach slid greasily up into her throat when she moved one way, and back down her spine when she turned the other way. She tried to concentrate on her surroundings. Along one side was a narrow catwalk with a rail above it.
Remind me again what happens if we disturb the growing whiskers?
They shatter and impale us with the shards.
Ah, so I guess we don't disturb them. Minimal vibration, minimal temperature variance, we slide on the rail.
Esme watched as Seska made a circle of his suit glove loosely around the rail and pushed off from the lockout hatch. He slid away and away and vanished into the darkness. Esme noticed that he'd pushed off precisely in the axis of motion he wanted. His legs simply trailed behind him.
I hope there's a bracket on the end of this thing.
Freeze did the same thing.
Lieutenant, it's my turn to be rear guard.
Esme wrapped her glove around the rail, loosened it in what she hoped was the right amount, then kicked off. It was a strange feeling. She was drawn along effortlessly, as if the rail itself were moving, and she could see nothing but the faint reflection of the greenish-purple glow on the bulkhead, a long, vague blur of not quite color. When she slowed, she didn't at first realize it. Then the blur steadied. She thought it was motionless.
Now what?
If she moved around too vigorously, she could bang into the bulkhead and disturb the whiskers. She moved very slowly, bringing her other hand to steady herself, then turning to look back the way she'd come. Far away now, she could see the little cluster of lights at the lockout hatch. Nearer, something was coming, sliding along, too fast. If Bowry hit her, they'd both hit the bulkhead, if not worse. She gripped the rail and pulled herself along, hand over hand, trying to let her body trail without twisting. She couldn't watch and move at the same time, not without twisting, and she didn't want to go too fast. She didn't know how much farther she had to go. She glanced up from time to time, matching speed with Bowry, and as he slowed in his turn, she also slowed. Somewhere ahead of her were the others. She didn't want to slam into them either.
Slow now.
Esme hoped Bowry heard it too, but she didn't look, just put out her arm to brake against her movement. Her legs slewed sideways, but she was able to stiffen her torso and keep them off the bulkhead. When she turned to look forward, she saw the narrowing, rounded end of the fabrication unit and the big, round lock that allowed completed jobs to be taken out. To one side was a smaller personnel lock. Why did they even have locks at this end when the point of SpecMat Fab was its hard vacuum and zero-G? She thought of the answer almost as soon as the question. Of course, they didn't want all the debris in space getting into the unit. The personnel lock was manual, a simple hatch control that required only strength to turn. Then they were outside, clinging to the grab-ons and loops that Esme thought were misnamed as safety features. Beside it were a row of communications and oxygen jacks.
Top up your tanks.
Esme had almost forgotten that standard procedure. She glanced at her readouts. It hardly seemed reasonable to spend any time now for just a few percents, but the others were all plugged in. She shrugged mentally as she pushed her own auxiliary tube into place. When tank pressure reached its maximum, she pulled the connection free. Seska clipped his safety line into the first loop and started pulling himself along, up the rounded end of the fabrication unit, alongside the arching supports for the Whisker transport system. Esme followed Freeze again, with Bowery behind her, stopping to unclip and reclip her line every time it ran out. When they got to the upper surface, upper as defined by the Whisker track, Seska paused. From here, the size of Kosciusko surprised Esme all over again.
Check.
Two.
Three.
Four.
We'll take the transport line. It'll save us time.
Nobody mentioned how much air was left. No one had to. Esme could see on her own suit gauges that they had spent 20 minutes cycling through locks, traversing the long tunnel of the fabrication unit, climbing up this far. And now they had to go back the same distance they'd come, cross the entire ship, find a way down to one of the locks opening into T3's repair bay. Inside, walking along the decks, even running up and down ladders, they could have done it within the limits of a suit tank. Out here? It didn't matter. They had to. Seska clipped his line onto one of the rails of the transport line and pushed off. They followed. Esme had wondered how far beyond the ship's surface artificial gravity projected. As they came over the edge of T1, with the dome of the bridge ahead of them, she could feel nothing. But when she looked, her legs had drifted toward its surface. The transport track led directly over the domed core of Kosciusko, and Esme thought that if she had not been both rushed and frightened, she would have enjoyed the view. The five blunt-ended wings splayed out around them, the dome itself studded with shield generator points and an array of retractable masts for communications and remote sensing. She looked for, but could not see, any other ship shapes against the stars. The escorts were out there somewhere, but too far to occlude a noticeable patch of the starfield. It was easy to lose track of time in that long traverse of darkness. The glowing numerals inside her helmet flicked through the tenths of seconds, then seconds, then minutes. She did not look at her oxygen gauge. If it went too low too fast, there would be no helpful bomb disposal team to hook up a new one for her.
Trouble.
That was Seska. Esme looked his way. Beyond him, the star field shifted suddenly.
They're maneuvering.
Her mind froze up. But even as Seska said it, she had it figured out. Someone had decided to rotate the ship. And that someone could not be the captain. But it could very well be the Blood Horde commandos in control of the bridge.
The Serrano Legacy, Once a Hero, is continued on the next CD.